Okay, good afternoon. We can begin the last session of this worship. And just in order to make a very short introduction of our speaker, Professor Strong is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Missouri School of Law, and his research lies in the areas of international dispute resolutions, comparative law, and also jurisprudence. Now, her dissertation has the title Mass Torts and Arbitration, and in order to finish at time and not to use an abuse of my time in the presentation, just it's your time. Thank you so much.
Muchas gracias a Diego y a Miguel Martín y a todos por la invitación de hablar en este foro privilegiado. Es un gran honor estar aquí en esta ciudad tan bonita. Es mi primer viaje a España y me encanta el país. Empezamos el miércoles con un tema abstracto y terminamos con un tema muy práctico. Yo hablo de un tema diferente, el derecho procesal y particularmente de arbitraje en el contexto de las obligaciones civiles. Hablo bastante rápido en inglés, entonces dígame por favor si hablo demasiado rápido. Ahora en inglés. I'm sorry, I keep wanting to say una tema, but I was told very clearly it's un tema. Entonces, all right, my subject is mass torts and arbitration. And as you will probably see amongst the written contributions, I tend to write long. So as Mark Twain used to say, if I'd had more time, I would have been shorter. So I apologize for that. But it is a somewhat different subject for this topic, and I did feel the need to set the context for my discussion. Mass torts and arbitration is actually quite controversial. In fact, I don't think anybody's actually written about it before. Mass arbitration is relatively new in itself. In the United States, it's been around since the mid-1980s, but didn't really get going until 2003 when the United States Supreme Court said that basically arbitrators have the ability to decide whether to move forward in a kind of a class context. The reason I'm talking about this subject today is when I was very kindly invited to come and speak, I thought, torts, my gracious, what can I say about torts? I used to teach torts in Cambridge. But then this lovely case came down, Abaclat versus Argentine Republic, and it's in the international investment arbitration context, which is a public forum. It's a treaty-based form of arbitration, but for the first time, it involved a large number of claimants pursuing a claim against a state. And the thing that was different about that case is those 60,000 Italian claimants all signed consent forms. And to me, this sounded very similar to what might happen in the mass tort context. It's a little different on the respondent side because of the nature of a investment arbitration. There's a treaty in place, which is presumed to be an offer of arbitration from the respondent. But I'll kind of talk about that, and then I'll avoid it altogether because it doesn't really help us in the mass tort context. But basically, I thought that this would be a really interesting way to talk about the possibility of mass torts in arbitration because up until this point, people have said that it's impossible, not because torts are not arbitrable, not because mass torts aren't arbitrable, but because there's going to be problems primarily with consent. The points I'm going to talk about primarily are mass torts in the cross-border context, and I'll get into what that is in just a moment. I wanted to kind of set out a roadmap of where I'm going to go so that you can kind of hold me accountable in case I get off point. I'm going to start with what kinds of mass torts may be amenable to arbitration. I'm not going to be talking about every mass tort on the face of the planet. And in particular, I'm going to be excluding those that arise out of a contract where a pre-dispute arbitration agreement is in existence. To those of you from the United States, that means consumer arbitration, because there is a pre-existing contract, there is an arbitration agreement already in place. I'm excluding those. Those have been dealt with a lot in the class arbitration context. Instead, I'll be talking about things like, you know, exploding factories or possibly even a contract situation, but where there is no pre-existing arbitration agreement. The one example that I keep coming up with is the Bernie Madoff financial fraud situation. He probably had client agreements with all of his people, but it didn't have an arbitration agreement in there. Then I'm going to be talking about the basic problems of mass torts in the cross-border context. The third point I'm going to go to is whether mass arbitration can address some of the problems that are inherent in cross-border litigation. Because at this point, we all keep saying, well, what's wrong with the courts? I'm going to tell you what's wrong with the courts, and then I'm going to tell you why I think arbitration can solve most of those issues, but then creates a whole new problem. And then I'm going to talk at the very end about how ABLCLAT solves some of these problems, particularly regarding consent, and I might even talk a little bit about proof, because that is actually the topic of this conference. So the first thing to think about is that the concept of cross-border collective redress is a really hot topic, particularly in Europe. The EU recently did a consultation paper looking for primarily litigation responses to cross-border instances of collective relief, but also mentioned that there might be alternative means of dispute resolution. The International Bar Association, the IBA, has also done a position paper to the EU and has looked at several cross-border mechanisms. The American Bar Association and the Canadian Bar Association have both created protocols for cross-border class actions between the US and Canada. And interestingly enough, you would think, Canada, United States, really, how different can they be? They're different enough that a cross-border class is really quite difficult. A few have been done and a number have not. And I go into, in one of my other articles, I go into that in great length. The ALI, the American Law Institute, has also talked about aggregate litigation, and the OECD has also dealt with this particular subject. So it's a whole alphabet of people who are dealing with this particular issue. So what mass torts are amenable to arbitration? When I first started researching this issue, it became apparent to me, at least, if not to you, to me it looks like mass torts as a field is defined by procedure. It's either defined in the United States by class actions, to some extent aggregative mechanisms, but outside of the United States, in Europe certainly, you're looking at a definition that's based in process. We have so many factual scenarios that it's very hard to say that one rule covers them all. And I've pressed each one of you, I think, at different points during the last 3 days saying, so what do you think about this? And, you know, is there a real law of torts, of mass torts, or law of tort? Which is it? Is it one thing, or is it a bunch of different other things? So looking at process, I think, makes sense. And again, it makes more sense to me because I'm a proceduralist than perhaps to you. It does make our job harder, however, because you have all these different types of procedures that need to be tweaked to handle different kinds of situations. This is particularly true in the international context. And am I going way too fast? Because I did promise you that I spoke fast, but I haven't seen any hands going, oh, please help me slow down. Too fast or okay? A little slower. Okay, I will try. I get very excited about my subject, so I tend to go faster. So in the international scene, we have even more, and the nice thing is if I go fast, sometimes I finish early, and then we all get to go home, because it's Friday. I heard a yaw over here. Yes, please, finish fast. So in the cross-border, but wait, our taxis aren't here yet. In the international scene, we have even more problems, because we have real conflicts of the types of processes that are being used. We used to just have the United States class action, and then the rest of the world had regulation or nothing. And the usual counterpart was the United States on one side and Europe on the other with its regulatory schemes. But now there's a real multitude of procedures that are out there. We have the U.S. class action, and we're all pretty familiar with that mechanism. It's opt-out for the most part. It's representative. Punitive damages are often associated with it, although they are certainly not necessary. And then you have the lovely joy of American-style discovery. You have juries and a few other things. But those are background actions, background elements of U.S. process. In other jurisdictions around the world, both civil law and common law, you can have a U.S.-style class action that has all of those mechanisms that the U.S. Class action does, but many of them tweak it a little bit. For example, they'll only allow opt-in as opposed to opt-out. Opt-out is when I say, by the way, all of you are a member of a class unless you tell me otherwise. That's typically what happens in the United States. Opt-in would be me sending you notice going, would you like to be part of the class? And you would have to send me something in return saying, yes, I affirmatively want to be part of that class. So some places have a type of representative mechanism where you have to opt-in. Some of them have a representative mechanism where you have to have a named intermediate organization that could be a political or a governmental agency, or it could be a kind of a private trade association, But essentially that association takes both the financial risk, because now we're talking about who pays jurisdiction, so you could be on the line for costs, but takes the lead in the litigation tactics, et cetera, and goes forth and takes that claim on behalf of all the others. Sometimes you have a class action mechanism that is, as in the United States, transubstantive. Any substantive area of law, tort, contract, antitrust, whatever, it doesn't matter, the mechanism is the same. But in some jurisdictions, it's only tied to one particular substantive area of law. So you may only be able to do shareholder claims in one country, or you only can do certain types of other claims in another country. So those are the kind of representative mechanisms and the tweaks on that. Another major type of mass claim mechanism is the aggregative model. The English group litigation order is one of the best known models, the GLO, and then the United States multi-district litigation is another mechanism. So these are, they're very similar to the opt-in mechanism in the representative context. Basically, you have to sign up in some way. You have to join the roster in England and join onto to the case in a certain way. A test case may be done or a lead case. You may be joined only for issues of procedure in the early pretrial stages and then be sent off somewhere else for individual procedures on damages, et cetera, but it's a little different. And the third one is settlement-only classes. And this is seen in the Netherlands for the most part. They have a great Collective Settlements Act 2005, and they're very much the leader in terms of creating a class for settlement in the cross-border context. So I've talked in other contexts about why these various mechanisms can or cannot be put into arbitration. I mean, and it seems quite legitimate. One of the things that you may say, Stacey, is not at all legitimate is the way that you cite yourself in your bibliography with such sheer abandon and shamelessness. That's not because I'm shameless. It's because there's not a lot of people writing in this field in the cross-border collective context, and so I have to write. I have to keep citing myself. But yes, I recognize that it looks like sheer hubris, but also there's a lot packed into some of those other articles, and I don't want to repeat them in the already long article that I gave you, so that's why I keep citing myself. So there's a number of these kind of litigation-oriented mechanisms, and a number of these types of processes have gone into arbitration. The United States, although it's the best known for having these class arbitrations, there are also other jurisdictions that have thought about it. Canada has not adopted class arbitration, but has kind of considered it, I don't want to say in passing, but they've been very careful in the judicial opinions not to utter the words class arbitrations. But they've looked at class claims up against an arbitration agreement, and that's really, those are the two elements that you need for a class arbitration. So they've thought about it and contemplated it, and Manitoba, which is one of the provinces, has actually legislatively contemplated it. Colombia, the country of Colombia, has also rendered at least one arbitral award, it's a judicial decision that talks about, well, you've got class claims, because they have a class action legislation, and you've got an arbitration claim, and maybe the arbitrator should go think about this. So it may have happened in Colombia, we don't know. The joy of arbitration is these are all private, so you don't know what's going on. The ICSID case is different, the Zapaclad I'm talking about, because it's a public treaty-based arbitration, so we have access to all the documents, or a number of the documents and the awards. There's also a mechanism in Germany. The DIS is the German Arbitration Institute, and I will not for you with my bad German, but they have a collective form of shareholder arbitration in that jurisdiction, and that has been around since 2009, and there has been no cases that I'm aware of that have been decided under that, but it's now permitted to have shareholder arbitration in Germany, and Spain has also enacted a provision which I will, since they're leading expert on Spanish collective action is here in the audience, I'm not going to pretend to say anything about it. So we have these other types of mass actions in arbitration, but they're all contract-based, again, meaning that you have some kind of contract with a pre-existing pre-dispute arbitration agreement. And we've had a number of people say, well, that's all very nice, and those include tort-type claims. I actually, after I submitted the paper to you guys, I did some more research, and I found a number of cases on a public class arbitration database. There's a number of financial fraud cases that are out there, and a few other, I mean, they're honest tort cases, they're misrepresentation, et cetera. There's not a lot of them, but I've only started going through that database. So they're out there. But can we get this post-dispute arbitration agreement? And the problem has often been with consent. One of the questions I want to raise is a question called arbitrability. And this means, is the type of dispute amenable to arbitration? Individual tort claims can go to arbitration. If I have a slip and fall and I'm either at Walmart or I'm in my next door neighbor's backyard, either one, we can agree and say, let's go to arbitration. Sure, fine, stay out of court. That's absolutely fine. Individual tort claims are arbitrable. Mass torts in this contract context are arbitrable. There has been no claim that says you cannot have a misrepresentation claim or a fraud claim in arbitration. There's never been any dispute about that. So that to me suggests that other mass torts in other contexts, things like product liability, mass disasters, you know, Chernobyl or the nuclear plant in Japan, that those are ostensibly arbitrable too. But I recognize that there could be some claims that these are mass disasters that involve a certain regulatory element, certainly environmental issues, have a public regulatory type issue, but even a mass tort of product liability and such. I recognize that some people might say that needs to be in the public sphere in some way. So that may be an issue that comes up. One of the nice lines in the Abaklat case notes that nobody has ever lost the arbitrability of a particular type of claim simply because there's been a large number of similar claims. So I think that argument about arbitrability will probably lose, but it is a type of public policy issue. One of the other things that I need to say straight off is when a lot of people think about arbitration, in the United States they think about consumer arbitration, and I think outside of the United States they also think about arbitration or consumer arbitration. In the United States, you have these pre-dispute consumer arbitration clauses that are considered potentially unconscionable and onerous. You are not allowed to have the pre-dispute arbitration agreements in Europe because of certain European legislation. But in both cases, you think, oh, this is cheap justice and the poor little person, we have to look out for them. You need to recognize that not all types of arbitration are created equal. They can be quite different in the processes and the level of sophistication. So once we get up to a level of a mass claim, you don't have a little person anymore. You have a pretty big person with pretty sophisticated counsel, sophisticated arguments being made, and it looks a lot more like international commercial arbitration to me. And because that's my specialty, that's probably why. But I do think that it's important to keep that differentiation and to kind of set aside your concerns about consumer arbitration or labor arbitration to one side, because now we are dealing with people, or if not people, entities that are similarly sophisticated, have similar bargaining power, and are able to have a much more formal process. Commercial arbitration, whether it's mom and pop businesses or multi-million dollar businesses, can often be much more formal and can often look a lot more like what the processes that are in court. Maybe you won't have the full rules of evidence, but it will be more formal than the kind of, hey, let's just show up and you don't have a lawyer and let's just go. So we're a little bit in a different situation here, and the concerns about procedural fairness, that's the other issue that might come up with mass torts. The concerns about procedural fairness are either, I don't want to say non-existent, they're either lessened or they're different. And the procedural concerns that have arisen in the U.S. class arbitration context are the same kinds of procedural concerns that you see with class actions in U.S. courts. So just to recognize that there's a bit of a difference there. All right, so now we have mass torts, and our current option is to have litigation. So let's say, you know, we have some a pharmaceutical, this happens actually with some frequency, pharmaceutical injury. Half of the claimants are in the United States, half the claimants are in Canada. You would think both common law systems, really similar legislation, but they both have really similar class action remedies, although there's a little tweak on where the source of law is. Why don't you just have an international class? That's much more efficient and you know, it's a plus for everyone. Well, these are where we get the problems. There's four issues that I raise with respect to the problems to cross-border litigation of mass claims. One is jurisdiction, one is enforcement, one is procedure, and one is conflict of laws. The jurisdictional argument is, can one of these courts, whether the United States courts or the Canada court, can they get jurisdiction over all of these people? Usually to have jurisdiction, they have to be in your territory. Well, if I'm in Canada, and somebody's over the border in Vermont, yeah, you may be close. You may be closer than if you're in BC, in British Columbia, but you're not in my jurisdiction. And therefore, do I have the power to assert the power of my court over you? Can I drag you in, particularly as a claimant? And this is where, as you probably know, you have this weird twist, because now you're trying to assert jurisdiction over claimants, and it's because of the opt-out issue, normally if a claimant comes, they've consented to jurisdiction, so you just need to worry about the defendant. But this is a quirk of the collective action realm. So you may not be able to get personal jurisdiction over all these people. You may not be able to extend, I as Canada, maybe I can't extend my law extraterritorially. So that's legislative jurisdiction. Can I affect somebody who's not in my physical territory? Notably, the European Union has somewhat fewer issues with the jurisdictional issues because of the Brussels I regulation. And so in Europe, you may not see this kind of jurisdictional issue quite as much. And I won't get into that. I wrote about it in my paper. And if you see any errors, please let me know. There's one or two things in there I'm like, ooh, I think I missaid that. But if you see more, please let me know. So the problem with this jurisdictional issue is it can lead to inefficiencies because you're thwarting the purpose of mass tort actions, basically, which is to have a single forum, single time of resolution for issues of efficiency, et cetera. You could have different rights and remedies based only on location, and I've spoken with people, some people are okay with that. If I have a drug that hurts me in Canada and hurts someone else in the United States, they are perfectly all right with having different remedies in just because of where you live. I have a little bit of a problem with that. If it's the same injury from the same person, why should that be different? I'm still injured in the same way. But I recognize that that's a point that people can differ on. You could have inconsistent results. That's a little bit of a harder issue. I haven't seen it so much in the mass tort situation, but if you think in the antitrust competition law situation where poor Microsoft, who we all worry about, but Microsoft had competing inconsistent judgments, shall we say, from the US Department of Justice and from the European Commission on what to do with some of its gizmos, to use the technical term. And then also you have a real problem with parochial judgments. If you have not necessarily an international class, but you have maybe even a domestic class and an international defendant. And this is seen, I think, with some clarity in the Chevron versus Ecuador case, or the Ecuador versus Chevron case, where you have a mass environmental tort in Ecuador. They're suing Chevron. Chevron's the foreign defendant. I'm not saying if they're right or wrong. I'm not even going to go into that. But what the concern is that that Ecuadorian courts are going after Chevron as the deep pockets and damning them just because they're a foreign defendant. And that is a concern that all multinationals have whenever they're in a foreign court. Second point, enforcement. EU is a little bit different. You've got, the Brussels I regulation. Rest of the world, we have no international treaty or international or regional treaty to deal with enforcement of foreign judgments. So it's based on comity. As I say to my students, that's comity with a T, not comity with a D, as in ha-ha. So comity just means goodwill. Hey, we like you, France. Yeah, you may be civil law jurisdiction, but you know we think we're all the same, and we're going to recognize your judgments, and it's going to be fine. Until sometimes we don't like whatever you've said, and you're like, oh, they don't have juries, and there's this civil law thing, and we just do evidence there. What are the rules of evidence? We just don't get it. And then all of a sudden, there's no more comity anymore. And it doesn't happen too much between the U.S. and France. They're all kind of the same world. But when you get the United States and Yemen, United States and some other countries that the United States has real concerns about their justice system, it's a real problem getting enforcement of foreign judgments, and vice versa. I don't want to be mean to Yemen, but Yemen probably distrusts our jury system as much as we distrust their system. So you have this real problem with enforcement, even on the bilateral front. Once you get multilateral, then you have this huge concern, again, about representative relief, and particularly when the United States was the only jurisdiction with representative relief, there was a concern that what are these procedural rights that you're using and that you're taking away? For those from the U.S., you may or may not be aware that in many civil law jurisdictions, the right to assert your cause of action is individual in nature. And a representative action, particularly on an opt-out front, seems to disregard that particular right. And so that's one of the reasons why there's this great concern about class actions outside of the U.S., at least before everybody else started kind of jumping on their own collective bandwagon. There's also the concern about individual defense rights. Okay, maybe you all have agreed to band together and have your individual litigation rights offensively, but I, as a defendant, need to be able to see each of you and each of your claims and deal with the individualities of each of those allegations that you're making against me. So a class and collective enforcement situation is much more problematic. When you get down to procedure, there's also issues there. There's this clash between different types, private relief versus regulation, type of notice, And this, as I said, these background notions of discovery, punitive damages, juries, et cetera, the rest of the world doesn't really like our discovery, doesn't really like our, meaning U.S., juries, et cetera. So it's kind of different. And then conflict of laws, we have the right to proceed as a class. Is it procedural or is it substantive? There's certain issues that have gone in the United States in Stolt-Nielsen, which is one of the recent classes, and in Canada in a case called Seidel. So, can arbitration cure all this? Three of them, I think there's some really good options here. Enforcement is going to be really easy. There's something in the world, not just the United States, it's called the United Nations Convention on the Enforcement and Recognition of Foreign Arbitral Awards. And it's a convention that's commonly known as the New York Convention, signed by 146 parties. That's massive. It's the most successful commercial treaty of its type. And it just means that enforcement of a foreign arbitral award is almost rubber stamped, so that you have the opportunity to get very, very easy enforcement. It's kind of like the Brussels reg. Yeah, there's a few public policy and procedural grounds that you can object, but for the most part, you're going through. Procedure, this is a massive improvement. No juries, no pretrial discovery. In fact, disclosure in arbitration looks a lot more like civil law disclosure or even English disclosure. You don't necessarily have rules of evidence, and so you can get some of the other information and you don't worry about hearsay. And since England has done away with hearsay, I don't know about Australia. You still have the hearsay rule in Australia? Yeah, I don't know. I do torts. I don't do evidence. but England has done away with the hearsay rule. You can tailor the procedures to really suit the dispute and to suit the parties themselves. And so even if you have, as I said, aggregative in one jurisdiction and representative relief in another, you can kind of meld the two or decide which type of procedure you want to use. Here's a big one. You can have specialized decision makers. We've talked a lot about, the juries or the judges don't understand epidemiologists. They don't understand the technical statistical arguments. You could have a statistician. You could have an epidemiologist on the actual jury, or not jury, on the tribunal. The Chartered Institute of Surveyors in the United Kingdom does a lot of arbitration. There's a lot of people who are qualified arbitrators there, and I've never understood why. Is the ground so unsafe in Britain that we just need a lot of surveyors as arbitrators? I'm not sure. But they have really been very, very active in that area. And there's a number of engineers as well. And then they're neutral. They're not geographically aligned. They don't have a national bias. And then again, you can get away with this issue of evidence, as I said. Conflict of laws, you can get past certain exclusive jurisdiction clauses. And then on jurisdiction, it's very helpful. You don't have to meet any of these jurisdictional tests of the various courts. Instead, you just get consent. Unfortunately, here's where we have the problem, the consent. You need to have some level of consent to arbitration. And you can't get it in most of these cases in a pre-dispute arbitration agreement because you're not going to know that Chernobyl's going to blow up, so you can't go out and get that arbitration agreement. Or, Bernie Madoff decides not to put an arbitration agreement in his contracts and you don't think of it as the client. So you don't have any arbitration agreements. So you need to figure out what kind of procedures you're going to use and how you're going to go about getting that consent. And here's where we start moving into the Abaklat case. What I find most amusing, I don't find it amusing generally. This is the only amusing thing I find. The lead lawyer in this case is a woman named Carolyn Lamb. She's at a U.S. law firm called White & Case, and she actually wrote the one article that I cite constantly that says back about 10 years ago, you can't do any kind of class arbitration outside of the contractual mechanism because you can't get everybody's consent. And then she went out and got 60,000 people to consent. So she obviously learned something in the intervening 10 years or so. So looking at the Abaklat case, it arose when basically Argentina defaulted on about $100 billion with a B dollars worth of sovereign debt in 2001. And that made everybody, all the bondholders' investments worthless. Eight major Italian banks banded together and formed this, and I will not offend the Italian speakers in the audience by attempting to say it, but I'll just call it the Task Force Argentina, TFA. Basically created this, everybody's laughing, saying, yeah, you're glad I don't do my Italian. It's this kind of agent that's going to work on behalf of the bondholders. And their whole goal was to represent the interests of the individual bondholders. First, they did negotiations for a few years, and then they went forward, and they asked the bondholders for a certain mandate. They asked for permission. In this mandate package, there were five documents: a letter of instruction that explained the purposes and procedures of arbitration with ICSID, which is the International Center for the Investment for the Settlement of Investment Disputes; declaration of consent, delegation of authority, and power of attorney. That's kind of all put together for Whiten case. Third is a grant of mandate allowing the TFA to coordinate this procedure. Fourth is a questionnaire asking for some documents and such, and the fifth is additional instructions for asking for the documents. The mandate package was initially accepted by 180,000 individuals, and then the number of claimants actually dropped to 60,000 eventually. They went through and they litigated, and what just came out this past fall and summer was a jurisdictional award. So it's not an award on the merits. It's just saying, do we have jurisdiction over these 60,000 entities? Some of them are individual persons, some are natural persons. And two people out of three said yes. One person said no. He's the dissenter. He then promptly resigned. It's getting to be quite common in international investment arbitration. I dissent. See you later. So there's a number of issues about the Abaklat case. One is that was a little strange is that there was some contest about dispute, but it wasn't the claimants disputing their own consent. It was the respondents saying all those claimants haven't really consented. And this is kind of a backwards argument in some way because it's speculative. It's not the respondent talking about their own consent, but what it's doing is it's protecting the res judicata argument, the concern that the ICSID award is not going to have preclusive effect once it goes through. So it is in some sense legitimate, but it's also incredibly tactical, because if you can stop it now, you're scot-free. You're either back in national courts or it's gone away. So the tribunal in Abaklat did a very nice thing, I thought. They didn't say yes or no fully, because this is just a jurisdictional award, but they said, quote, the tribunal shall give due regard to the fact that claimants themselves do not invoke such lack of consent, which may impose a higher standard of proof than if the mistake or fraud was invoked by the affected party itself. I have not seen that in any of the cases in the United States, and I think that that's quite clever, because it respects both interests. And I do think that in the private realm, we can use that a similar type of standard. So I think that's one way that Abaklat can help us out. Another way that the award is helpful is that it talks about the primary means of dealing with these kinds of claims, representative and aggregative. But it also talks about the purpose of these mass awards or these mass proceedings. And it says these various forms of collective proceedings share a common raison d'etre, and that was really bad, and I apologize to Jean-Sébastien. Collective proceedings emerge when they constitute the only way to ensure an effective remedy in protection of a substantive right provided by contract or law. In other words, collective proceedings are seen as necessary where the absence of such mechanism would de facto result in depriving the claimants of their substantive rights due to the lack of appropriate mechanism. So this is quite helpful because it's really requiring a pretty high standard of need. And I'll get into some other elements here. Remember, we do have actual consent here, either actual consent because the TFA has been signed by all the individual bondholders, and then we have this treaty-based consent under investment law. The tribunal did not say that the claims in Abaklat were class. They said that they were hybrid. So they had some elements of an aggregative proceedings because they had this opt-in mechanism at the very beginning. It looked like the GLO. You kind of go and you have to sign and opt in, and that's not representative. That's each individual making an individual decision. But then the majority thought that it had these class kind of elements, representative elements, because the TFA was acting as an agent and proceeding forward. The dissent said, no, there is no representative element anywhere because none of these claims are not homogenous. And this is one of the points where the two sides argued about, whether the claims were of the same type. Because one of the important parts of a representative proceeding in arbitration or in litigation is that, quote, in the final analysis, only one claim, albeit with many or even a mass of claims, has to exist. The tribunal thus deals with one claim and can examine every aspect of it specifically through adversarial debate and scrutiny that guarantees to the parties, particularly the respondent, all their due process rights. So again, this is an issue of evidence. You have to have either the same or substantially similar claims, because otherwise to group the different claims together would deprive the respondent of their defense rights, because they would be too different, and you can't aggregate and kind of guess. Now, if I have time, I will talk later. I mean, to U.S. kind of people, you're like, create subgroups or split liability and damages. You know, there are ways around this. The majority didn't talk about some of these various mechanisms because they're not there yet in the process. But we in the United States who are used to these kinds of issues about non-homogeneity can see that there are ways around it. But it is a legitimate concern of the dissent. So I don't want Georgia Al-Sabi to think I'm saying anything bad about him. All right. So let's see. One of the things that the award talked about is we're looking at consent and we're looking at admissibility. Admissibility would be kind of a contract claim issue, but it said the primary issue, jurisprudentially speaking, in representative actions are questions of consent. And this is why U.S. cases, both in litigation and in arbitration, are talking so much about did the claimants, and it's always about the claimants, by the way, did the claimants consent? What was the nature of their consent? How did it move along? And admissibility is more about aggregative proceedings because you have you already have their consent. They have opted in. They have signed onto the GLO. They have signed a TFA, whatever it is. So the type of consent that we see in the Abaklat case, there's three documents to focus on. One is the letter of instruction. And this is quite critical because it has a bunch of background information about ICSID actions, who can join, who cannot join, what will disqualify you, et cetera. It talks about the need to have a single attorney in a mass case like this. It says specifically it will not be possible for the bondholder to give instructions directly to the attorneys. The attorneys are going to coordinate with the TFA. And the TFA, acting in the collective interest of all the bondholders, will operate autonomously. So the language is geared kind of towards a layperson's understanding, but it nevertheless provides a real solid summary of what the law is and what rights the people are going to be giving up by joining this collective. I think that, this was upheld, so that's one of the reasons I think it's a good model, but it was quite helpful because it demonstrated some of the knowledge that you have to convey to the people when they're joining on to this action. One of the important things is that consent to some kind of collective relief needs to be free and it needs to be informed. So here with the letter of instruction, that was a major step towards the information phase. The other aspect of information was found in the power of attorney. And this was, of course, the legal document by which the power to act was conveyed to White and Case. And the power of attorney was relatively complete. I mean, it was pretty straightforward, being bound under D.C. law, and there was a question about which law. But it says basically this is an irrevocable consent to submit to arbitration. The further instructions regarding the delegation of authority can be made from time to time by a duly appointed agent. So it allowed some flexibility if White and Case decided to have a different tactical approach. But again, the validity of the consent needs to focus on whether there was free and informed consent. So anytime you're going forward in a mass tort case, you want to make sure that the consent is free and that it's sufficiently informed. The bondholders were deemed to be somewhat more sophisticated than consumers. So you do need to take into account who your class is. It could be that if you have a Chernobyl blows up, these people are not going to be sophisticated as the bondholders in ICSID. So you're going to want to make that language a little bit more accessible. And of course, it'll have to be translated into the necessary languages. The TFA mandate is the third document that I want to talk about. And this was quite helpful because it laid out the scope of powers that the TFA had. And it really is soup to nuts. It talks initially about the ability to negotiate with Argentina, the ability to initiate an ICSID action. And then it goes through basically step by step to each element of an arbitration, the power to appoint arbitrators. That's usually individual in nature, and so you have to grant that to the agent. You have to have the power to take any additional proceedings that may be necessary. You may need to go run to court to do something or other. Usually you're not supposed to in arbitration, but you may need to. So this power has been provided. The ability to negotiate and enter into settlement. Many of these settle. You want to give that specific power. The power to obtain recognition and enforcement outside of Italy. That's what I was talking about a little bit about the New York Convention. But you want to make sure that power, that's the final power you want to give them. And then there was a general savings clause that says, quote, in general, to take any step that it deems useful in the recovery of the amounts due under the bonds, which is great. You're thinking, oh, fantastic, we're done now. And then it goes on, subject always, as an absolute priority, to equal treatment of all the owners of bonds issued by Argentina who have signed an identical power of attorney or attorney ad litem and an identical mandate. And this is very helpful due process language or procedural fairness, to use the non-US term, because it demonstrates that there at least is a recognition of the potential for breaching due process rights when you get, you know, certain powerful bodies like these eight banks. They may want to settle, and that may not be in the best interest of the bondholders, et cetera. It's not going to be complete immunity for the TFA or a complete immunity for any actions that are taken, but at least it's a good step forward to demonstrate that they recognize that this duty exists. So I would suggest that anybody in the future uses that. So there's three kind of useful lessons that come out of this claimant consent in the private arbitration. First, it identifies some practical means by which you can get the consent from a mass group. And one of the ways that I don't think I mentioned before, the consent was actually obtained by the eight banks who were members of the TFA. They went to all their customers. They knew who their customers were, and they sent out letters to their customers and got their documents back. So this is a little bit like the consumer context, et cetera. You know who your people are, and you can get them. But if you think about other kinds of mass torts, the blowing up of Chernobyl, you're going to have to do the same kind of digging in that case in arbitration or in litigation. And then we get into some notice issues, which I haven't talked about. But it's not going to be a much different or much more onerous or less onerous task than it is going to be in litigation. It's going to be somewhat similar. The second way that the award is helpful is that the ways that it identifies issues of importance in class and collective arbitration, particularly that consent is important to representative relief, and admissibility is important with aggregative relief. And it demonstrates that some of the consent issues that are important in other kinds of class arbitrations in the contract context are not going to be at issue in a mass torts type of arbitration, because you're going to have a post-dispute arbitration agreement called a submission agreement or a compromise. And then the third thing is that this award puts the lie to the context that it's just impossible to get consent from hundreds or thousands of people. It can be done. It may be hard, and you have to have the right documents, but in fact, it can be done in the proper circumstances. So moving on to the consent from the respondent. In the class context, either class litigation or class arbitration, and the same thing in the collective context, the problem here is not practical in the sense that who is the respondent? How are we going to find them? You very seldom have a defendant class. You know who Chevron is. You know where you're going to find them. You know where they're located. Here, the issue is tactics. Are they going to want to be in arbitration? Are they going to want to be in a bigger potential class or not? And this is where, of course, people are going to just go back and forth. In the United States, there is, of course, the sentiment that defendants will never want to have a bigger class, that they're going to fight everything tooth and nail. If you think about the fact that, A, you're not going to have punitive damages in arbitration, because in international commercial arbitration, they're not enforceable. They're considered criminal in nature, so you can't enforce a punitive damage award outside the United States. You can have it awarded, you're just not going to enforce it. You don't have juries. You're going to have a good, faster procedure. You're going to have a decision-maker who actually knows what they're doing. And you're not going to have this inconsistent judgments, et cetera. There are plus sides to being in arbitration and having that finality. The Chevron versus Ecuador case, that's been going on for a decade or so. You've got arbitrations at the Permanent Court of Arbitration. You've got cases in the United States. You've got cases in Ecuador. The amount of money that is being racked up is insane. And one of the things that nobody's really talked about is, do the shareholders actually, and the board of directors actually have a duty to start talking to their CEOs, et cetera, about having a cost-effective dispute resolution mechanism? Is this really a good use of Chevron's money to be spending? They're probably spending at least $1 million a month on attorney's fees, probably more. Some of the cases I've been on, we spent $1 million a month, and it was nowhere as big as this. So, you know, it just tactically, it doesn't make sense to go forward some of the times. Sometimes, you know, don't go to arbitration. I'm not saying it's good for everybody, but it's something, and particularly outside of the United States, I think it's something to think about. So that's mostly tactical. So briefly about the procedures, because I see I've just hit time, but everybody in the last day and a half has gone over, so I'm going to take that benefit. The procedures that were mentioned in Abaclat were quite general, because it was a jurisdictional award. But the arbitrator said it's too early to make these far-reaching opinions. We need to know more about the case before we go ahead and say what kind of procedures. But they did say that there would need to be some adjustments to the way that the evidence was presented. And see, this is the way I'm bringing this talk into the actual context of the conference here, the workshop. They said that adaptations to the present case collectively would concern not that much the object of the examination, but rather the way the tribunal will conduct such examination and or the way the claimants are represented. So there may need to be certain new mechanisms for simplifying the introduction of evidentiary material. These might include either the depth of examination of a document, like accepting a scanned document as opposed to an original. It might deal with the number of evidentiary documents to be examined and their selection process. Do we want random selection instead of a serial examination of each document? They just didn't know at this point, but those were some of the options that were raised by the claimants. And the respondents, Argentina, said, oh no, these are bad, it hurts our defense rights. If you're thinking that all the claims are not homogenous, yes, that could potentially be a problem. If all the claims are substantially similar or identical, it's much less of a problem. But even if you're in somewhat on that gray zone and you're closer to more similar than others, I got to tell you, in complex commercial litigation, which is not dealing with this many claimants and which is not dealing with this amount of money, you have a massive range of documents, many of which are identical. You don't go through all of them. If you have a 3-day or even a 3-week or even a 3-month hearing, and in complex, I just did an arbitration, I was sitting and we had 25 parties. It was only 1.5 million, so it wasn't that much money by our standards. But it was a 3-day hearing and they had a whole lot of duplicative documents and they really did move it into evidence en masse. They pointed out a few lines on each of them that they thought were relevant, but they knew it was a better use of their time to kind of give a gist than to try to go document by document, and both sides were okay with that. So I don't see that this would be a real problem. You're not going to get any tribunal who wants to go through 60,000 identical signature cards, and there's no use to it, and it would be really bad advocacy. So for Argentina to kind of raise this as an issue, I think is a little bit specious. So that's one of the kind of evidentiary proof aspects that might need to be contemplated as a change. The other one was the representative mechanism, and we've already talked about that the TFA was acting as an agent, and the tribunal was completely fine with that. The key here for the majority is that the only time this group method of examination would be proper is if there is a claim raised by a multitude of claimants who have identical or sufficiently homogeneous claims. And the standard in Abaklat was quite high. There had to be homogeneous rights of compensation for homogeneous damage caused by potential homogeneous breaches by Argentina of homogeneous obligations provided for in the BIT, which is the bilateral investment treaty. So if we translate that to the mass tort situation, there would need to be homogeneous rights of recovery combined with homogeneous injuries caused by homogeneous breaches of the relevant duty by the respondent. We may not be able to meet that in all circumstances. Maybe there's going to be individual damages. Maybe we're going to ask for injunctive relief and it's going to be homogenous. Maybe it's going to be individual damages, in which case we could bifurcate, or in which case we could have subclasses. Whatever the possibilities are, I think that lawyers are capable of coming up with those if the parties want to be in arbitration. And then again, it just comes down to a tactical choice. So summing up, I do think that this is a subject of great interest and importance, not just to me, because I'm writing a book that's going to be coming out from Oxford University Press in about the end of this year, beginning of next year. But I do think that the kind of interest that the EU is experiencing at this level and the other organizations demonstrates that this is a big issue. You're going to have continuing visa claim cards. You're going to have continuing cross-border products liability causes of action. The cross-border element is just not going to go away. It's going to get bigger. The other issue to bring up in summation is, if you're interested in this subject, I'm doing a workshop on it at NIAS, which is in The Hague, where I'm currently on fellowship, so please come talk to me later. If you want to do a work in progress presentation, that would be great. Laura Caraballo will be speaking from the Spanish perspective, so she will be there, but it'll be quite good. But other than that, muchas gracias por su tiempo.
Okay, the debate is open. Professor Giussani.
To me, it's the most interesting one, obviously.
And proceduralists bond together.
To me, I have actually dozens of issues I would like to discuss, but I try to contain myself to four.
I'm getting my pen out, I'm writing this down.
One of these is, what do you think the class member with the higher stake is the best representative. You know, Private Securities Litigation Act apparently didn't work very well. Here we have banks that, as I understood it, are the biggest stakeholders automatically considered good representatives. Maybe that should be discussed a little. Another question is, how would you plan to deal with the issue of lawyers' fees? That is probably, from my point of view, it's correlated because it's main aspect with adequacy of representation, the issue of how would you deal with lawyers' fees. And the third one is, if the parties do settle, would the tribunal check the fairness of the settlement in some way? And the fourth one deals with, well, the most probably theoretical, but not only important issue, also in Italy, we have this rule, is not actually applied. The recent shipwreck in Italy, victims will sue in the US, obviously. Well, we debated a lot about this issue, about the issue of, and we describe it like that, if the defendant raises defenses against only some of the class members, does this defeat homogeneity? Well, obviously it seems absurd that only raising the defense can defeat the class action, because the defense may be just abusive or frivolous. In Italy, there is not an effective sanctioning system against frivolous defenses. And, some proposed that if the judge finds that the defense raised is sound, then the class members would be excluded from the class with no prejudice. So that would not be res judicata on the actual rejection of the claim, but just a procedural holding. And I would like to know what would you think about this problem. Thank you.
Okay, lovely. Opens doors to things that I love to talk about. First, about the class members with the highest stake, should they be or must they be the representative? I have not actually thought about who should be the representative in any capacity. The TFA here certainly had the largest exposure, and there was also the allegation of a conflict of interest or potential conflict of interest, because if the ICSID class action, and you know this because you're from Italy, so you've been following this, but if the ICSID action doesn't work or it hadn't been alleged, these bondholders would have been going over the banks themselves. So there was an alleged conflict of interest that the banks were protecting themselves and kind of misleading the claimants, and that was part of what was going on with the consent argument that was raised by Argentina, which was why it was in some regards potentially legitimate. I would say that you need to look at the national law of the jurisdictions in concern, because you may have a situation where only an intermediate organization, maybe not a TFA, but a governmental agency or a trade association, like a labor association, is the only one that is qualified under that national law to assert a collective claim. So you need to look at that. Beyond that, then, I think it comes down to national law. I don't think that there's any requirement under U.S. law for representative class actions that the person with the highest stake act as the lead claimant. It just needs to be somebody with a legitimate claim. And actually, in the Abaclat case, it used to be Bacara versus Argentine Republic, and then Bacara either settled or she pursued another claim, and she went away. So now we're next in the alphabet. It was A Becara, so alphabetically, and now it's Abaclat. So in some class actions, it can just be whoever's there. So I think this was situated procedurally a little bit differently, but we in the United States are not used to seeing the association suing on behalf of the class. So I think that's something that U.S. courts U.S. counsel are just going to have to deal with. The second question was lawyers' fees. An excellent question. The TFA is actually funding the case in Abaclat. So again, they're making a cost-benefit analysis that if they win against Argentina in ICSID, their liability under domestic law is you can't have double recovery, so they're going to be fine, and so they're willing to pony up the amount. If you have one of these associations suing, that's one of the reasons why some of these jurisdictions have an association is the only person who can, legal person, who can assert a claim, because they're going to make the cost-benefit analysis of whether they want to be subject to those reversal of fees and costs if they lose, and they have the pockets deep enough to handle it. There's also an issue, and I think those in Europe are seeing it more than those in the United States, of litigation funding and whether this is permissible or whether it's impermissible as a matter of national law, because it's kind of taking an investment in a litigation. But there are investment funders out here, I know some in the Netherlands, but they're available, and basically they say, yeah, we think you have a good enough claim, we're going to fund you. And so it takes away the issue of contingent fees, which are unavailable outside the United States for the most part. But somebody just decides that this claim is good enough that we're gonna pony up the fees. So those are the ways I think that you need to look at it. There's also the possibility in arbitration that if there is a public interest at stake, some kind of public interest, and a mass tort might qualify, that you shift the usual fee shifting or the usual fee arrangements. Maybe you let it sit on both parties so you don't have fee shifting. And there might be some discretion in the arbitrators to handle a kind of public interest argument. So I talk about that a little bit, I think in this paper. Maybe it's another paper. I can't remember my papers anymore. Hopefully that answers some of your questions about lawyers' fees. Settlement, in the United States, there is no judicial check of the fairness of the settlement amount under the various rules that are used for class arbitration, but the arbitrator must do a quasi-independent, quasi-neutral fairness check, similar to what a judge would do in a class action. But the court does not review the merits of that analysis by the arbitrator. Well, it could be seen as a potential conflict of interest, or not. I mean, the arbitrator is going to get more if it goes forward. So, you know, maybe there's only a conflict of interest if it's denied. If it goes forward, then they're acting somewhat more altruistically. So it has been handled in the class arbitration context, but certainly in the ICSID, there's not going to be any mechanism other than the usual Article 52 review within the ICSID system. But it is something that people are concerned about. And in other contexts, the concept of consent awards not being permitted to be approved by an arbitrator, you have to go to a court to have a consent award. So it is a live issue. And then the shipwreck issue and raising of defenses, and whether that defeats homogeneity, I would say that some arbitrators would see that as a potential tactical move and might say, let's look at your defense, you know, let's go to liability forward and we'll bifurcate. And if we need to hear defenses separately, let's just see if we're even liable. Because if we're not, then we don't even need to reach that issue. We don't need to exclude other issues. And that may be because of the U.S. concept of you, in some cases, certainly like before settlement, you need to give a new moment to opt out. You wouldn't be able to opt out, but at that point you could decide, all right, we're going to have subgroups, or we're going to have, you know, people who have the re judicata vis-a-vis liability, but their damages have not been ascertained, and they can take that forward in their own court. So the problem is there have not been a lot of class or collective arbitrations that have gone all the way through to conclusion. When I say not many, I don't know if any have. there may be one. I remember talking to the AAA at one point, and they said, well, one's on the brink of it. So we don't have a lot to look at, but you know, scholars can come up with any idea they want, and we can look at the U.S.
So that's my turn. Thank you very much for this insightful presentation. It is very interesting. I have read a lot about you, and it's fantastic. But I have also doubts about international commercial arbitration, because my problem is with respondents' consent, in the sense that, for instance, the experience of Spain is pretty bad. We have collective arbitration, but as far as I know, we don't have any cases. Why? First, because our collective system is not working that well. Now it's working much better, but anyway, respondents are not interested at all in going into arbitration. So I think that we have the same problem. That was also the problem of Argentina. She was the one not going into, not wanting to go into arbitration. But I guess you had thought about specific mass torts in which it could be really interesting going into arbitration. So I would like to have some comments on that topic. And it is very interesting, all of this work done by this lawyer, gathering consent from the claimants. It's been really very detailed. But once you have arbitration, adjustment arbitration sentence, then you have also appeals.
So
appeals. I mean, you have the possibility to claim that sentence is void. So had this lawyer also thought about it?
Yes. On the last one, there's certainly in the TFA mandate the power to take care of any enforcement or recognition. So they're of course assuming that they're going to win, because then you want to take the award to whatever jurisdictions you can to satisfy the judgment against any of Argentina's assets around the world. So they have that, they've been given that power. And that's one of the important things, is to make sure that you have all of the powers initially, because what you don't want to do is realize that you forgot, for example, to put in the power to appoint the arbitrators, because then you have to go back and make sure that you get the exact same 60,000 people, because if you're missing one, then you're in deep trouble. So they did contemplate giving that power to the attorney. In terms of the problems in Spain with the collective arbitration and who best might be the defendants, you and I had discussed a little bit, but I want to mention for other folks, there's a U.S. scholar named Peter Rutledge, goes by Bo, because in the United States it's important to have nicknames. Bo Rutledge at Georgia, and he's going to be publishing an interesting piece in the Journal of Dispute Resolution. He just presented it at a symposium I did, where he talks about the reasons that drive parties to arbitration versus litigation. And one of the reasons that he comes up with is it's not just the ease of enforcement, which has been the conventional wisdom. It's so easy to enforce the awards, that's why people go to international commercial arbitration. His view is that's one of them, but the reason why that's important is because it's really different from litigation. So what will drive people to class arbitration as opposed to class actions is if there's a real difference between the litigation regime and the arbitration regime. For example, in the United States, avoidance of discovery, avoidance of juries, and avoidance of potential punitive damages in the international realm should drive defendants, respondents to arbitration, the ability to tailor the procedures. That should really, really drive them to arbitration, if they're thinking, but they're not thinking that way yet. Right now, they're just trying to kill the class remedy as much as they can. And I think we talked about this before, and I don't know enough about the Spanish system to say this with great confidence, but it may be that the Spanish litigation system is so similar to the Spanish arbitration system that none of the parties are seeing any kind of distinct benefit yet to being in arbitration. So the kinds of respondents who are going to want to be in arbitration are those who are going to see a big benefit either by eliminating certain procedural downfalls like the jury and discovery, or who see either duplicative litigation, or I see the concept, the specter of parochial judgments. Chevron does not want to be in Ecuador for an environmental disaster. They just don't want to be there because they're always going to feel a negative judgment is going to be based on non-neutral reasons. And they think they're never going to get fair justice. They should be in arbitration. And on that side, there's really no downside to the respondents to being in arbitration, unless they think that they've rigged the courts, in which case they're not going to consent. But if they have a legitimate claim and they think they're legitimately right, then they should be okay in arbitration as well. And actually, the plaintiffs would want to be in arbitration, because if they can get this done for fewer transaction costs and in less than 10 to 20 years, that's to their benefit. They get some recompense. So I think looking at how different the arbitral regime will be from the whatever litigation regime you're going to be in, that's going to drive who goes to arbitration. Does that make sense?
Guadalupe Martinez.
I would like to bring up the standing issue, because I think that's really important in the case of Argentina. Collectivization is more like a right-based, class actions are right-based. We have this distinction between collective rights being the environment and consumers, like the paradigmatic cases, and the individual homogeneous rights. And this, I think that you were emphasizing a lot this idea of the free and informed consent. And it has to do a lot with the idea behind that is that the collectivization is based on individual rights that are divisible, disposable, so you have the freedom to litigate those rights on your own. So to to aggregate, you need to give your consent because you are kind of renouncing to your right to litigate this individual right. That is, so I think this is really, I mean, it's helpful to understand because I think, I don't know, I think that in the US, the idea of class actions is more like a conflict-based idea. You are grouping, I don't know much, but I have this intuition that it's not about right-based, I mean, being individual or collective, but being this is an individual or it's a collective conflict. So I think that makes a difference, and I think that makes that standing has two faces. It could be, I mean, like a procedural face or side of standing that is having this device, this class action as a device, as a procedural device, and the substantive side of standing that it has to do with who has the standing to initiate this kind of aggregate and class actions procedures. So I think, I don't know, I think that that's a distinction that, I don't know if you agree with that, but because I think that it's not about just procedure. There is some substantive base that is there, and I think it has to do with all these things you are emphasizing about free and informed consent and homogeneous individual rights and so on. And another comment, you mentioned... What?
Very short, please.
That's...
Oh, you scared me. I think you're absolutely right that there is a potential for substantive rights in here, and The U.S. courts are not clear about that. The Canadian courts are not clear about that. But I certainly see this is a potential hot issue because of the regulatory nature of torts on an individual basis and certainly on a mass basis. So I think that the concept of divisible and disposable rights is a concept that's considered in the principle of arbitrability in the arbitration world. Can you freely dispose of your right? And that's why the whole free and informed consent issue. One of the issues that I used to do comparative constitutional law, and the concept of collective rights would come up more in that context. I've read some jurisprudicians who talk about how the Western notions of, and they're probably looking at the US and Europe, but the Western notion of individual rights being very clear, and certainly when I was speaking down in South America, I saw that there's more of a understanding of collective rights. And so when you talk about collective rights to the environment, we would probably talk about that in the United States, not so much as a collective right per se, but like an injunctive right, which has the same kind of thing. One person sues on behalf of either on behalf of all, or at least affects the rights of all. But I think it's our anti-communist concerns. In the United States, we just don't talk about a lot of collective rights per se, even in a labor context a little bit, but even our labor movement was very different than in certain European nations. So I think we've hidden and run away from that concept, but you are right, very right, to distinguish the different ones, and there may be issues where an environmental tort, like the Ecuador situation, could go forward, whereas a more individual-based products liability, I have individual damage, couldn't or wouldn't, et cetera. So there's definitely a lot of work to be done here.
Okay, we have only 15 minutes and 5 questions. Then
I can talk faster.
No.
Please stop. No.
Short questions and short answers will be grateful, will be welcome. Professor Stapleton.
This is not my field at all. In fact, this is probably the first time I've really understood anything about arbitration. I guess my question is, all the carrots that you've been suggesting are for the respondents, and I can't really see what's in it for a torts victim. Clearly, I can see it if it's a systemic misrepresentation and it's an economic loss thing. But even economic loss, you take the Lloyd's names. Why would a Lloyd's name want to do this? Why not go to the London bar and get the absolute Rolls-Royce QCs fighting in open court, and then if they lose, they can appeal? So I've got a real problem with that. But even in the States, it seems to be even more problematic. In the States, you've got, because of contingency fees, you've got a very, very expert bar who've got qualities that are honed for jury trials. So I'm worried about who's going to be taking my case, quite apart from the problem about different quanta between the individual plaintiffs. But as an individual plaintiff, why would I opt into this? Why wouldn't I say, fine, other people can go and do the group arbitration, but I'll stick with my jury trial in the States with my clever entrepreneurial counsel and hope for the best.
Yeah, and I think you're quite right that I've focused a lot on respondents because I feel that they're the ones that I have to convince more, and so I've given more time to that. The carrots for the claimants would be faster resolution, because you're not going to go through the multiple appeals. It's going to be certainly for those jurisdictions that do not have a robust collective rights regime. One of the issues is in, at least from what I recall from the Apicot Award, Argentina does not have an individual mechanism. It would have been 60,000 individual cases. So with a number of jurisdictions that don't have a collective rights regime, then they want to be in on one of these kinds of actions. And from the respondents' rights, defending 60,000 individual lawsuits, they don't want to be doing. They also don't want to be doing it in arbitration. One of the things I didn't bring up, but was in my piece, is that AT&T, who was the big winner in the U.S. Supreme Court case of AT&T versus Concepcion, they blocked a class arbitration. They then were subject to over 1,000 individual arbitrations, and they got very upset about that. They're like, when we said we wanted bilateral, we didn't really mean bilateral. And they went to court to stop the customers from suing them in arbitration. And that never actually went all the way to court. The Department of Justice stepped in because it was an antitrust issue. So I think with claimants, you need to see, do they have any other reasonable remedies? They can still pick their QC. They can still pick their US-style plaintiff's lawyer. It just will be heard to a slightly different entity. It'll be tried to this tribunal, who could be better for them. I mean, if you think about... No, the lawyer still... A lot of lawyers are as happy to be in litigation as they are in arbitration because they're still getting paid the same amount that they're paid in litigation. But if you're a claimant, a group of claimants who have really tricky technical information, really tough, you don't want to go to a U.S. judge or even a U.S. jury who's going to misunderstand. You do want a specialist neutral. So, but those are very good points. So I'll make sure to bump up my claimant side.
Professor Green.
Stacey. When it comes to homogeneity, which seems pretty critical to your argument, the history of mass torts in the United States, when we try and think about aggregation, is the closer we look, the more layers we realize that we have to peel away, and that what looks like something that superficially is homogeneous, when we get down and dig in the details, we discover that it's not at all. So let me just take your environmental hazardous waste spill and say, one question is, wherever the spill begins, everybody as we go out radially, right, are different in terms of the exposure they got. And then we're gonna have people with a variety of different diseases, and the question about causation, general causation for those diseases is going to be different. And then even with regard to the same diseases, we're going to have the specific causation question, which is not going to be homogeneous. So I'm skeptical that in almost all mass torts, there may be an exception, and maybe Bhopal. But even there, I see problems with homogeneity. But that sort of single event may be the closest. But I don't think you're going to have the homogeneity that you are contemplating in the mass personal injury tort. It just seems to me it's totally different from bondholders who lost their investment. The other comment is, as an American lawyer, I am just horrified that my clients, representing plaintiffs for the moment, are going to go into arbitration without having discovery. But then I quickly realized the solution I would take if I were representing multiple ones. I'd say, okay, I understand the streamlining, but we're going to keep a few people out, and we're going to get American-style discovery to get those documents that often show up that damn the company and it's what it's done.
And in terms of the discovery issue, I was talking about this with earlier, you can get some disclosure, and you have a lovely joy of adverse inference, so there are ways to get to that damning influence. It's not the same as the American style, but it's worked for a lot of other jurisdictions in mass torts and others. And you can be as skeptical as you want, and many of them will be skeptical as they want. I'm not trying to sell this for either all mass tort cases or even any mass tort cases. This is just a first run at, could arbitration work here? Because I think there are some scenarios where it could work, and a lot maybe where it doesn't. But it's another option for people. People like, you know, the Chevron situation, the Bernie Madoff situation. And I'm a commercial lawyer, so I see credit card injuries, and I think, boy, those look pretty homogenous to me. But environmental issues, maybe you're getting injunctive relief, and you're stopping the noxious fumes. That would be amenable in a way that personal injury isn't. And maybe you're bifurcating on damages and liability. So yeah, there's a lot of downsides, but there's a lot of downsides to everything.
Okay, 4 minutes for questions and 2 answers. Professor Karen Pass.
Lisa Bernstein has a fantastic article about opting out from the court system to some form of ADR, especially in the area of cotton growers in the U.S. South, and she has also another one about diamond in the diamond industry. And one of the things, when she analyzes the advantages of opting out, one of them is the issue of confidentiality, that it's not public. And I wonder to what extent it's relevant here. On the face, it seems to me that it's relevant much less as an incentive to opt into ADR, but I wanted to hear what you think of it. And if it does exist, how does it stand with respect to what you mentioned earlier in your talk of arbitrability. given the sort of like public interest in it.
And I did deal a little bit with the concept of privacy and confidentiality in the larger paper. Typically, there is an expectation of confidentiality and privacy in arbitration. It needs to be contractually based because it actually doesn't exist as a matter of background, international and national law. But in the U.S. class context, class arbitration context, it's been a little different depending on which arbitral rules you go under the AAA, the American Arbitration Association. The documents that you file will be published on a public website. Under the JAMS rules, none of it will be public. So the AAA is trying to deal with some of the issues about mass torts, which is the deterrent issue or the publicity, some of those other concerns they're trying to get to. And usually the fact of arbitration is not confidential, and usually the fact of any eventual award would not be confidential. But it is something to be concerned about, but it's also one of those pluses for either, if you are a member of a class of children who have been abused by Roman Catholic priests, do you want to be in court or do you want to be in arbitration? You might want to be in arbitration for your own personal, peace of mind. And the Roman Catholic Church might be very happy to be in arbitration because of that. So there's pluses and minuses. From the societal view, I recognize that there may be a concern about wanting to do the deterrence and the public damning of bad social actors, et cetera. But does that answer your question in terms of the ups and the downsides? Yeah.
Okay, finally, Professor Wright.
As you can tell, I have more problems being short than being long.
Yes. I think that most of them have been addressed. I think that even in litigation, there's a problem with even in litigation is that corporations very often want to force people to sign secrecy agreements, and so the information doesn't come out to the public that should come out in terms of continuing conduct. And so if the arbitration route would lead much more towards secrecy, I wouldn't be very much in favor of it. I think also that I'm not sure if I heard you say who would be the arbiters in this. Maybe you said and I missed it, who would be the arbiters, and I would wonder about how they're chosen and going into it. Do you know, it sounded to me like from the standpoint of the people signing up, the 60,000, they're pretty much being asked to sign for a black box, a pig in a poke. They really don't know what's going on. And again, the limited discovery sort of issue is very troubling. I know that American discovery is bad, it goes too far, but I've talked to a lot of people in civil law countries that said, we wish we had some discovery. We're supposed to be trying to find the truth here, and we can't get any evidence we need to be able to do that. So I can understand why respondents would love to have no discovery, but, so if you kind of sign this sort of thing and it kind of says there's no discovery, there's limited discovery, it turns out that's essential for your case, I wouldn't sign it.
The first point is who are going to be the arbitrators. Typically, in a complex case like this, you have three arbitrators. One is chosen by the respondent or respondent group, one is chosen by the claimant or claimant group, and then those two arbitrators together choose the third. If there is an inability to decide amongst one of those groups, typically an arbitral institution or possibly a court, if you're not going through an arbitral institution, will choose it. That person will be definitely be neutral and impartial and independent of the actual dispute. So it's not going to be, hey, Joe, you know, you're my buddy, come on, be my arbitrator. It's not going to be that. In terms of their qualifications, that may be included in the arbitration agreement, but only a very naive person would say, hey, let's just get Joe Schmo from down the way because I know he's cheap, because I'm going to have a multi-billion dollar deal here. They're going to go out and they're going to research intensively to find one of the very many incredibly qualified arbitrators out there. And certainly in an ICSID case, these are the top people in the world. And some people call it an elite club, but this is an elite club of really clever and highly principled people from my experience. So those are the arbitrators. And in terms of the disclosure versus discovery, it's a little bit like John Rawls' original position. Sometimes you just got to, you sign, and this is really true of pre-dispute arbitration agreements. In the commercial context, consumer, labor, anything, you don't know where you're going to be situated when the dispute comes up, and that's to some extent the upside. In a submission agreement like this, you are to some extent going to know where you're situated, and maybe you're going to wait to go into arbitration until after the class has been certified, and I realize many people just settle at that point. But in terms of a disclosure versus discovery, you have a lot of flexibility for the parties to agree and or the arbitrators to use their discretion. There are something called the IBA rules on the taking of evidence and the production of evidence in international commercial arbitration, which is very helpful in giving some predictability to the process and to kind of going halfway between the common law and the civil law. And then there's the concept of adverse inferences. If you say, I've got a document that says, in regard to your letter of March 3rd, 2002. Where's your letter of March 3rd, 2002? And the other goes, oh, I lost it. You know, if you can say that probably had a damning information, and I have had cases where I've sat, and the other side brings up adverse inference, and they're darn right. I can make that adverse inference, and I will when the other side doesn't produce the documents that I know that they have and suspect that it would be damning, because if they were good for them, they'd be producing them. So it's not perfect, but it's worked very well in the ICA realm.
Okay, thank you so much. I would like, in order to finish, to thank all the speakers and participants on behalf of the all members of the organizers, entities, the Institute of European and Comparative Private Law, the Legal Philosophy Research Group, and the Share in Legal Culture. In civil law countries, and specifically in Spanish-speaking countries, it is not very usual to have meeting points like this between private law scholars and legal philosophers. I'm very happy because I think that the results of this meeting, of this workshop, has been excellent. And last but not least, I would like to express, I think, our grateful to Diego Papayanis for his wonderful organization. Thank you so much. Thank you.